Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. People who have Asperger's syndrome, that is, they're on the high-functioning end of the autism spectrum, have difficulty reading social cues, like when someone's bored or annoyed or excited. But not being able to tell the difference between a frown and a smile doesn't mean those with Asperger's don't crave love, a partner, maybe marriage. But forming those loving bonds when you can't read your partner's expressions can be tough. This hour on Point, love in the time of Asperger's. You can join the conversation. Have you wondered whether two people with Asperger's could form the kind of loving bond that might lead to marriage? Do you know someone navigating Asperger's and romance? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York City is Amy Harmon, national correspondent for The New York Times. She covers the impact of science and technology on American life. She's the author of the new e-book, or e-single, titled Asperger Love. Amy, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
Well, the numbers are stunning, frankly. Since 2007, autism diagnoses are up 72% in this country. How did you first become interested in reporting on this topic of navigating love and autism, which includes all the autism spectrum disorders, correct?
Right. Well, in this book, I particularly focus on Asperger's syndrome. I mean, as you know, the autism spectrum is very broad. And so and one of the important things that accounts for the increase in the numbers is a broadening of the definition and sort of a recognition that you think of classic autism and you think of kids who, are maybe nonverbal, maybe self-injurious, have really challenges with basic sort of self-care. That exists, and they have, one set of, difficult challenges. This other group that I'm really focusing more on in this book, which has traditionally been defined as having Asperger syndrome, shares this very basic challenge in social interaction, and just in social communication and being able to, as you described earlier, understand the social cues that other people intuit, to be able to read a facial expression or just understand an emotional reaction that somebody's having. I was interested in this generation because it's such a larger group that's just beginning to come of age, that was diagnosed at much greater numbers as children. And I was interested in, what are their challenges as they become adults and move into our society. I had focused, to some degree in previous articles on employment issues and, friendship, but I was hearing from all these young adults that I was talking to that what they really cared about was a relationship, was like many young adults, they wanted a girlfriend or they wanted a boyfriend.
Right, so many people assumed that those with Asperger's were incapable of, or I guess even indifferent to, relationships. But come to find out, that's not necessarily true.
Yeah, I think there is this kind of pervasive myth about people on the autism spectrum that they prefer to be alone and that they because they don't maybe express emotion or react to emotion in the same way that people without autism do, that they don't have emotion. And, I learned especially a lot from talking to Jack and Kirsten, that is really not true.
So tell me about Jack and Kirsten. This is the couple you write about in your ebook. What did you want to share in their story?
I thought that, having talked to people and realizing that this was such an, that forming intimacy, that, ties was so important to them, to people on the autism spectrum, just like it is to people not on the autism spectrum, I was impressed by the challenge of that. I was, I felt like, wow, relationships are hard enough when you don't have autism, I mean, for many of us. So what is it like to try to have a romantic relationship when your neurological condition makes it difficult for you to put yourself in the shoes of another person to really, to sort of intuit what they're feeling. And I just thought that it would be a way to explain to the world what it is like to have this condition by focusing in on a couple who are trying or sort of in the struggle to make a romantic relationship work.
You wrote about Jack and Kirsten in the New York Times in 2011, I think it was. I'm curious, what was the response to that article?
You know, it was an overwhelming response. I have to say, I got hundreds of letters to that in responding to that article. You know, some from people with Asperger's syndrome who were saying, you know, I can see myself in this, and you know, or parents who were concerned about their children growing up with this condition and wondering what it would be like, and finding it, you know, to some degree hopeful. I think to hear about Jack and Kirsten, and the other set was from people who actually had no connection to Asperger's syndrome, because, you know, one of the things that I realized in the reporting of the story was that, you know, I thought, well, this will give insight for, you know, people who don't know what autism is like, you know, to explain what it's like. But in a way, you know, Jack and Kirsten's struggles are the struggles of anyone who is trying to form an intimate relationship, and they just have more built-in difficulties. So I think I also got a lot of response from people who said, wow, you know, I don't have autism, but this sounds, you know, I can see what they're doing here.
Well, let's bring them in. With me now from Amherst, Massachusetts, the couple that Amy profiled in her book, Jack Robison and Kirsten Lynn Smith. Kirsten is a 21-year-old student at UMass Amherst, and Jack is a 22-year-old student at Greenfield Community College. They've been a couple for more than 3 years now. Welcome to On Point, both of you.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Hello.
So, Jack, let me start with you. I'm curious, growing up with Asperger's, did you think about love, about the possibility of someday being in love? Did it interest you?
Sure. I mean, I think it does to everybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I you know, expected that I would try to get a girlfriend at some point when I was little. I think that probably most little kids think something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Kirsten, did you have the same experience?
Yes, though I didn't grow up knowing about autism. I didn't get diagnosed until I was 19, so I didn't even realize that there would be, you know, a stigma, the idea that that would be hard for me in the first place. Also, I thought that it would just happen, that of course, you know, when you come to a certain age, the magical number for me was 16, one of my male friends would just become my boyfriend. That's just how it worked. So I just assumed it would happen.
And so, Jack, how did Asperger's impact your social life as a teenager and then sort of moving into young adulthood?
Well, I sort of always thought of myself as being visibly different from my friends, and I think that they sort of behaved as if I was too. I thought the same thing about my father and my mother, that, you know, they were completely unlike any of my friends' parents, and I saw that I was completely unlike my friends. So I didn't really know that it was called Asperger's when I was little, but it was a visible difference, and I never really had a problem with it. It's just, you know, the way that I saw things.
Can you explain to me how your mind thinks differently about love? You say you always wanted it, but for those of us who are on the outside, what does it feel like? I mean, what's it like to navigate a friendship or a relationship when you are on the autism spectrum?
Well, I guess I really can't compare it to anything, but
right.
I think that, you know, it feels the same as for anybody else. It's just that, you know, people with Asperger's don't have the same sort of level of communication as neurotypicals, as they're called. So, you know, we might sort of feel the same on, you know, in our heads on the inside, but we're not as good at interpreting information and expressing information. So,
and yet, when, you know, when you can't read the difference between a smile or a frown, I mean, you can't look at basic differences in emotion. I mean, that seems to be a landmine, right, when you're dealing with love? It would be for anyone. Kirsten?
Well, I mean, for one, we can tell the difference between a smile and a frown. But there are people who can't, for one. But
right.
For me especially, it took until I literally looked up body language dictionaries to learn minor differences, like small things of how to tell when someone isn't interested in what I'm talking about. So one challenge I had making friends was that, you know, a lot of people just didn't like me, and I had no idea why. Teachers especially, dentists, things like that, just didn't like me. I was hard hard to deal with, and I didn't understand why. Just some people didn't like me. And now that I'm older and I've learned this stuff intentionally, I can see some people, you know, I'll be talking, monologuing about a special interest, and some people are just bored, or I make them uncomfortable, or, you know, as a little kid, I would be hand flapping everywhere, which would be freaking people out, and I didn't understand that. I couldn't read their reaction.
Hmm. Jack, what drew you to Kristen? What drew you to each other?
I don't entirely know initially. She was interested, you know, I tend to ramble about my interests, and she was very open to them and, you know, actually wanted to know more about them, and that can't be said for many people.
I read that you told Amy you feel more comfortable around someone who has Asperger's. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, in particular, Kirsten, but I mean, I don't... Yeah, I mean, there's sort of like an understanding when you're talking to somebody with Asperger's that you can sort of pick them out of a crowd and there's like we're on the same level.
You both dated people who did not have Asperger's syndrome, and I'm curious, Kirsten, how was it different?
Well, for one, I noticed that, you know, emotional heart-to-hearts are very different. That my last boyfriend was very neurotypical and was very into, you know, oh, we have a problem, let's discuss it, let's get down to the basics, here's how I feel and here's why I feel that way. Now, your turn. How do you feel and why do you feel that way? And for one, in many instances, I don't even know how I feel. I can tell that I'm, you know, it's a negative or positive emotion, but beyond that, it's hard. I'll be, okay, I'm angry, but I'm not necessarily angry. I'm also sad and, you know, multi-levels of complicated emotions beyond that. So I don't know how I'm feeling. And then I definitely don't know why I'm feeling the way I'm feeling. And so lots of tearful emotional arguments trying to dig this out of me. And whereas with Jack, I tend to be the one who's even better at that than him.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing love and Asperger's syndrome this hour, how to find romance when you're not wired to connect. Today I'm speaking with Jack Robison and Kirsten Lynn Smith, a young couple diagnosed with Asperger's, each of them. They're joining me from Amherst, Massachusetts. Also with me from New York City is Amy Harmon, national correspondent for the New York Times. She profiled Jack and Kirsten's relationship in her new ebook, Asperger Love. But Jack and Kirsten, with autism spectrum disorders, your brain processes sensory input differently. So physical exchanges are sometimes challenging. For example, Jack, I was reading that the feeling of simply holding Kirsten's hand can just be too much, right? How do you negotiate that?
Well, in particular, it's because I have sweaty hands, and I really don't like the feeling of my sweaty hands, you know, touching another hand. That's kind of the main sensory issue at the root of that, I think. But, you know, I guess the result of that is that we sort of don't hold hands as much as some other couples. But
and you sometimes have to explain to Kirsten, I understood that your lack of expression doesn't necessarily mean a lack of warmth. Sometimes you just forget, too, right?
That, too. Yeah. I don't think of it just because I have sweaty hands all the time and it's unpleasant. So, you know, if she, like, really vocalizes it, I can, like, dry my hands off and, you know, just do it for a little while.
Kirsten, you guys don't often... You look like your relationship is pretty platonic from the outside, as I've been reading. People ask you, even if you're dating, are you guys really together?
Yeah, we once went to a speaking engagement where we were both invited with a bunch of other speakers, and afterward the staff was talking to us, and they said, oh, you guys are so cute together, like you get along so well. Have you considered dating? It was so embarrassing because we told them, yeah, we're already dating. We've been dating for like 2 years now. Mm. But yeah, we tend to come off as friends, or sometimes in public people think we're brother and sister. So, yeah, but just because we're not, you know, not as much PDA as you'd see in a neurotypical couple.
Kirsten, I wanted to ask you about a previous boyfriend, because I was reading in Amy Harmon's piece, nice as he may have been, he tried to tutor you out of your Asperger's, it appeared to me, tried to instruct you how not to miss certain social cues, tried to stop your hand flapping. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was interesting because, again, I didn't get diagnosed until I was 19. I sought it out myself when I started dating Jack and knew what was up. And so this previous boyfriend, he's, you know, very neurotypical, very emotional, very able to explain and understand his own emotions. And so unlike most neurotypical people who just intuitively get this stuff, but couldn't explain it. He could explain it. He had that kind of analytical level of understanding. And so we didn't know I, you know, was on the autism spectrum. We just knew I had problems with these particular things. And so he kind of took up the job of teaching me how to behave. And, like, if I was rambling on too long, he would, you know, whisper in my ear, like, they're not interested, change the topic, stuff like that. And at the time, it was obviously really difficult being in that relationship because I just thought I was broken. He felt that I should be able to learn this stuff and then be that way. Like, now that I know it, I'll just be that way. But because it wasn't just that I didn't know it, it was that I was also just different, that I had to be kind of, you know, faking it all the time. Now, because of this, I really appreciate what he did because I have learned a level of self-awareness that a lot of autistic people don't have. Mm-hmm. And I'm able to see myself as someone else would see me because of this. And I can, you know, maintain my own, you know, passing as neurotypical in public or in most instances, at least to a certain degree. But at the time, it was really hard because he felt that, you know, I should be able to do it. And I remember we once had a conversation speaking of the deep emotional conversations where I couldn't explain how I was feeling or why I was trying to explain. It was like the blue screen of death. I think this is in the story too, that there was just nothing there that I, for one, I don't think in words, and he did, so he couldn't understand that. And he tried to reassure me by saying, oh, don't worry, I believe in you. I know you can do it. You're a human being, not a robot. And so, of course, I felt horrible because I, being inside my own mind, can feel that, no, I can't do it. Not the way he wanted, not the way he expected. So it was hard being in a relationship with someone like that. But afterwards, I'm very thankful for everything that he did because I've learned a lot.
Let's get a caller in here. Dan is in Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Dan. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I have Asperger's as well. And I actually, in 2008, I got in a relationship with a neurotypical woman. Worked with me, and turned out, and last June we got married. But
so you have Asperger's, she does not. You've been married how long?
Since last June, so about 9 months.
Nine months. And how's it going? How are you navigating love and now marriage?
It's going pretty well. It is a lot of work, though. When we first started going out, we had confusions, and when I didn't respond the right way, or if I didn't respond to something and she was upset, then we had a lot of talks. We just sat down talking for hours, and now we're just very happy together.
Dan, thank you, and good luck. Amy Harmon, I'll bring you back in. I hear Dan speaking, and I think, well, it's a lot of work. Sounds like most couples. We had a lot of talks. We had to go through a lot of things. Yeah, right? What's the difference?
Yeah, well, I think that the difference is sort of a level of difficulty. I think what most impressed me about Jack and Kirsten was their, like, commitment to keep trying, just as the caller said, you know, just there was just it's a lot, and you know, for them, I think also coming up with, I mean, they were describing the lack of public display of affection, but you know, coming up with ways to get around that. So how do you so one of the things they did was engage in this very direct kind of communication. You know, I think that we're all kind of taught not to be so direct. Like, you know, if you're sad, often you try to hide it. You want your partner to read your mind, right? You want your partner to just understand how you feel and know what you need and not have to ask for it. But when you can't read the other person's mind, then, you know, it requires more direct communication. So they developed this system where Kirsten would say, well, when I put my hand on your leg, you put your hand on my back. You know, just so that she wouldn't have to always ask if she wanted affection, and Jack, who feels affection but might not express it just spontaneously, or as we said earlier, might forget, or you know, would know that she wanted that then and do it, and that seemed to work for them. So I was just impressed. So you know, I think that they, you know, other couples maybe who aren't on the autism spectrum wouldn't find that acceptable. But they did, and, you know, maybe we can all learn from that.
Let's get another call from Erica in Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Erica. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks so much.
Sure.
basically, I just wanted to kind of build on what you were just talking about there. I'm married to a man with Asperger's. We're coming up on our first anniversary now. And kind of what we've tried to do is learn to see from each other's perspectives. So I try to kind of understand the world the way he sees it. And in turn, he's trying to understand the world the way I see it, so we can kind of meet in the middle.
And so I'm curious, Erica, I mean, how do you attribute what's Asperger's and what's not?
It can be tough. Again, a lot of talking. Sometimes sitting down and asking, you know, what made you feel that you wanted to do that? When I ask questions about why did you think that, it doesn't usually work. But if I say, why did you feel you needed to do that, that tends to get across. And so... Sometimes we can get to the root of it. It's not necessarily that he meant to cut me off. It was he just didn't realize that we were still talking about this topic. He wanted to move on.
Erica, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. Kirsten and Jack, how do you negotiate conflict? The two of you, Asperger's syndrome, how do you call it an Aspie argument, I read. Is that true?
Yes. That for one thing I've noticed of couples I've talked to where one party is on the autism spectrum and one is not, that the one who is not on the autism spectrum will usually say, oh, I'm used to my partner, as Amy said, reading my mind, and how do I tell them what I need? And so they're usually, no, it's all about communication. The neurotypical partner will sit down with the autistic partner and say, hey, this is why I'm upset, point by point. You don't understand why I'm in a bad mood, so I'm going to explain to you, lay it all out, here is what I need. But the problem I find is that's most annoying, I'd say, with me and Jack is that when I am in a really bad mood, I can't necessarily do that, sit down point by point, here is what I'm feeling and why, because I don't necessarily know. I can tell I'm in a bad mood, and I'll sometimes even feel that, like, oh, I want you to hold me, but that's not so simple. I don't know what I want, and I don't know why I'm in a bad mood. And so, really, the key is that, as Amy said, it's the same for every relationship, communication. Mm-hmm. But with autistic relationships, it's just you need more communication. You know, tenfold more, put in that much more effort to force the communication to happen.
Jack, what do you see as the biggest struggle in your relationship?
Particular struggle. I don't really know. You know, the Aspie arguments thing is that's sort of getting at a specific type of sort of nitpicking argument that we can get into that I've found. I've had it happen with other people who have Asperger's, like Alex Plank. Me and him have had plenty of these as well, where it's like we disagree about kind of like a technicality about whatever it is that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And then we like really get into disagreeing about that. And we sort of don't get to whatever the bigger thing that we were talking about that involved that mm-hmm. little issue was. Mm-hmm.
Do you think about where you might be in 5 years, 10 years down the road? Do you think about the possibility of getting married and even of having children? Jack?
Well, I think about it. I don't really have any definitive plans, I guess. I don't really know. I'm sort of a one day at a time kind of person.
What about you, Kirsten?
I mean, I've thought about it, but I mean, I can't force Jack's hand. And for one, I think that marriage, especially in our society, is not, it used to be more of just, you know, a promise like, oh, get up in front of the community and say, hey, we're together. But nowadays it's a legal contract and it has a lot more implications and consequences. And so right now we don't really have a reason to get married. We don't really have any money. We don't like there's that right now getting married wouldn't serve anything and would probably cause more problems than it would solve. And so, I mean, maybe somewhere down the road when we, you know, have jobs and stable income and need to, you know, get health insurance and that sort of thing. But
let's
right
get
now,
another,
yeah, no plans.
Let's get another call in from Barbara. She's in Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Barbara. Welcome.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Go ahead.
Good. I'm the mother of an adult with Asperger's. He's finishing up college. He's 24, and something that occurred for him that sort of never occurred for us, or we never approached it, is he was, watching a movie with a girl and a few of her friends, and then at the end of the movie, the friends disappeared, and she was alone with him. And she told him to take off his clothes. And he had never been asked to do that by anybody, and he had no idea how to respond. He just did it, ended up in bed with her. Nothing happened. And he was really freaked out about it, completely freaked out about it. And I said, well, how did it end? And he said, well, I said, I'd like you to go home. And she did. But he had no real preparation in many ways for dealing with that situation.
What do you hear, Barbara, in Kristen and Jack's story?
Well, I hear that, first of all, it's two people on the spectrum, and I think that that helps in some ways, because you do know at least what your own Asperger's is like. And, you know, I'd be curious, you know, how did you broach a sexual relationship, or do you have one? Do you desire one?
All right, Barbara, thank you. You don't need to respond, Jack or Kirsten, but I'll put the question to you.
I mean, well, for one, a lot of people on the autism spectrum don't and are consider themselves asexual or aromantic, so we shouldn't just, you know, cross the board say that everyone with autism wants this. But most people do. I think most people with autism are just as sexual as neurotypical people, and that I do think a problem I've heard of people with autism being especially prone to abusive relationships or manipulative relationships or, you know, sexual assault, things like this, because of the kind of situation the caller was just describing, of people who just don't know what to do, don't know how to react, and aren't the best at gauging the situation. And so that can definitely be a problem. And I think that the fact that sex and romance and sexual education is kind of ignored for autistic people, especially students, say, in a high school or college setting, because everybody thinks, oh, they don't want it, or, oh, they're incapable of romance, so we shouldn't talk about it. And so these kids aren't necessarily getting the best sex education. They're getting, you know, what the parts are and how they work, but not how to deal with the social implications of sex, which is essential, I think.
Amy Harmon, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that what Kirsten just said is borne out in my reporting, in which, you know, and it's, you know, I can sort of understand it. I mean, parents and teachers who are trying to sort of prepare people with Asperger's syndrome, you know, in high school to live an independent life and to sort of integrate, get jobs, you know, they're concerned about jobs, you know, and they're concerned about, you know, and friends, and they don't necessarily want to touch this area of sex and romance. It's tricky, right? It's tricky for any parent.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and when you have so much else that you're struggling to, you know, try to help with, I think that gets sort of sidelined, and, you know, stories like this result.
What advice would you give to other people diagnosed with Asperger's about romance? Kirsten and Jack?
That's hard. I think, for one, do your research, you know, that the internet is a great resource. Just read about this stuff. Read about if you're in a relationship and you're not happy, read about what abusive relationships are like. Learn the red flags. Read, you know, other people's experiences. Find other social networks for people with autism to discuss these issues you're having with other people like you. And basically just, you know, learn as much as you can.
Jack, do you have the final word on that?
That's pretty much what I'd say, is just learn as much as you can. That's, you know, go on the internet and read body language dictionaries and read on the forums on Wrong Planet and ask questions.
Well, Jack Robison and Kristen Lynn Smith, thank you very much for your time today and for your honesty. I really appreciate it. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Many more of your calls coming up after this break. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about adults with Asperger's syndrome, also known as high-functioning autism, and how they can find love and romance. The MTV documentary series True Life made an episode called I Have Autism. They profiled Elijah, a student with Asperger's. He described the special school he goes to for Asperger's, but said he didn't see it as a disability.
There are only 8 kids and most of the kids that go there have Asperger's. But I don't really see Asperger's as a disability.
Many would agree. Certainly do not see it that way either. With me from New York this hour is Amy Harmon. She's national correspondent for the New York Times. She profiled a young couple with Asperger's that we just spoke with in her new book, Asperger Love. And joining me now from Sandusky, Ohio, is Dr. Max Wisnitzer. He's a pediatric neurologist at Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital in Cleveland. He's been treating patients with autism for more than 20 years. Doctor, welcome back to On Point. Always nice to have you with us.
Thank you for having me today, Jane.
So did you hear some familiar themes as Kirsten and Jack were speaking here?
These were the themes that I heard and I see not only in my patients, but also in the parents of my patients, because I mean, there's a genetics to this condition. And if you have a parent with Asperger's syndrome, it's much more likely that one of the children will have it than if you don't. There was just a lot of deja vu.
Mm-hmm.
And all this, and actually, if you want to break down some of the key points, the messages they were giving you, one is that they have difficulties looking at things from other people's perspectives, and they're somewhat concrete and literal. But that doesn't mean that they can't have relationships, and I think that's an important thing. They're individuals with a diagnosis rather than the diagnosis itself.
There are many couples where one person is on the spectrum and the other is not. How many couples do you see like that who are successful? And then compare that with, say, both that are on the spectrum.
The ones I mainly see are the ones where there's one couple with and one without.
Mm-hmm.
In that situation, it's rare. It's not common that you'll have both together. It's being reported more often now. A generation ago, that was distinctly unusual to do that. Although they were out there, people have reported on successful relationships that were occurring. One of the things you have to remember is what makes a successful relationship. It's not always infatuation. I mean, there's different reasons for relationships and definitions of love, whether it's security or comfort, stability. These are comments that I've heard from individuals within relationships, mm-hmm. as to why they're in the relationship.
What if a husband and wife with Asperger's syndrome want children? As a medical doctor, what do you say about their ability to respond to the cues of a child, of their child?
I think that while there may be some limitations, they can learn. I mean, these are people with normal intelligence, and as has been stated by your guest beforehand, they can learn how to read the cues. They may not do it the way that, as they stated the words, neurotypical individuals do it, but there's ways of doing it. One of the comments was made about, I have difficulties expressing my emotions. But you can define emotions as colors. I mean, the comment was made about the blue screen of death. It's a perfect example. I mean, red could be used as a definition for anger. Once you understand things like that, you can work with individuals and you can be successful parents. I mean, my patients have parents with Asperger's, whether they know it or not, the parent. And they do a very nice job of parenting their children.
So what I'm hearing you saying is you can gain skills that help you relationship. You can gain
navigate
those skills.
Parent.
You can go to therapy. You can go to coaching. You can do all those things.
Yeah, whether you're going to be in a relationship or a parent, and if you think about it with the typical relationship, it's the same thing that happens with us. If you're talking about being a parent, I mean, children don't come with guidebooks. And you talk to any parent who has their first child, it's a learning experience, and everyone learns in their own way. And as long as you learn, you can do a good job.
Let's go back to the phones. Josh is in Needham, Massachusetts. Hi, Josh. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
Well, I am a 16-year-old boy who has never been in a relationship, and I have Asperger's. I was diagnosed in fifth or fourth grade. And currently, there is a girl who I would like to date, but we have been friends for a short period of time, and I don't know how to tell her that I want to be more than just friends.
Josh, thank you for calling Dr. Wisnitzer. What would you say to Josh, 16 years old?
Well, I think you have to use 16-year-old networks. One way is always finding out from other friends about how she views him, for instance. I mean, this is a typical way that teenagers do it, but individuals with Asperger's may not know that this social network is in place. And then secondly, you can always do something as simple as just go out once and define whether a relationship might exist or might not exist. That's typically what happens with dating. But unless you explore or check, you won't have an answer in that regard. The worst that happens is the person says no. And that happens to whether you have Asperger's syndrome or don't have Asperger's syndrome. That's a very common event at age 16 years.
Amy Harmon, there's a proliferation of websites and forums that I've been seeing here in the last couple of days where these self-described Aspies or Aspergians trade dating tips, in some cases actually find dates. I mean, this is quite remarkable what's out there now.
Well, yeah, I think that that is what this generation has that previous generations haven't had. So I think it was in 2003 or so, I wrote a story about people who were being diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome as adults, and it had been so painful for them their whole lives, just thinking there was something wrong with them, that they had a character flaw, that there was just, you know, they were failing in some way because social interaction was so hard for them. And then they learned that there was a biological basis for that difficulty. And so having a name for it, having a diagnosis, I think has been helpful. And, you know, might even be helpful to the 16-year-old who just called in. I mean, there are people on these dating sites or who go on dates who feel comfortable to say to somebody, hey, you know, I have this thing called Asperger's syndrome. I may not always respond, you know, the way that you would think that I would, but I'm not being mean. I mean, often people with Asperger's syndrome come across as rude, right? They're talking too much, or they're not meeting your eye, or, you know, and it's not intentional. Mm-hmm. So to be able to say that, well, I have this thing and sometimes I don't, you know, act the way, you know, you might think is appropriate. It's not, I'm not trying to be that way. Mm-hmm. And if you tell me, I can change. So
let's go to another call from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My husband is an Aspie, and I'm neurotypical, and we've been married for 7 years. And the thing that I find interesting is because of the brain difference, he sees the world differently than I do, so our relationship never gets stale because we always have something to talk about how he sees things versus how I see things. And it, like I said, it just keeps things interesting.
How does your extended family deal with your husband, with your relationship? I'm curious.
They're really accepting. When you marry into my family, you're family. So, I mean, they just accept him for who he is, and, you know, it is what it is.
Elizabeth, thank you. Thank you very much. Dr. Witznitzer, how do you see families and parents reacting to these kinds of relationships? Sounds like it's a terrific setup in Elizabeth's family. Is it always that way?
No. And I was thinking back when the comments you were making about people taking advantage and such and educating the individuals. I think most people worry more in our culture about the daughters compared to the sons. And I think that making sure that people are informed of reasons why. In other words, if you understand why people are doing what they do, you can then basically know the person rather than get stuck with the behaviors and misinterpreting what the behaviors mean. Mm-hmm. Which means in these family units, as long as people know why it's happening, like I said, you had the example you gave of rudeness before.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly, once you understand it's not rudeness, but it's being directness,
mm-hmm.
And that there's somewhere concrete and literal, you then say it's okay. We know what's going on, and you go that way. As long as in family units, as long as you get along with people, and remember, there's introverts to extroverts from a social standpoint. You don't have to have Asperger's syndrome and still not be God's gift to socialization. There are people who just like to do it, and other people who don't like to do it as much. So that we have to look at it in that main way, that there's a broad spectrum, and we have to understand the spectrum.
Amy Harmon, in your reporting, how do families and parents react to these kinds of relationships, would you say?
Well, it was interesting because Jack's father has Asperger's syndrome. So to the point about genetics, you know, it does run in families. And Jack's father, actually, if people want to know more about Jack, Jack's father also has a book out now called Raising Cubby, which was his nickname for Jack. And it's all about Jack's childhood up until he meets Kirsten, which is where my book takes off from. But so for that family, it just seems sort of natural. You know, Kirsten, all of Kirsten's quirks and lack of affect and, you know, issues that pertain to her Asperger's syndrome was just something that Jack's father and mother had dealt with before. But So, you know, I think it's a range of reactions. I think, you know, I think the last caller who said that, you know, when you marry into her family, your family, you know, she spoke to a point that I really pressed Jack and Kirsten on, which is sort of this, you know, why is it worth it? Which is something that, you know, a family member might raise. Like, you know, this guy or this woman seems really difficult. Like, you know, why are you in this relationship? And I really wanted to understand that about Jack and Kirsten. And they had, like, excellent answers. I mean, as she said, you know, it doesn't get stale. But and for Kirsten, I think it was really, you heard her talk about her previous boyfriend and feeling like she always had to be kind of on her best behavior or faking it in some way. And with Jack, she feels like she can completely be herself. Mm. And there's no judgment there. They get into these, you know, long, passionate discussions over, you know, Jack calls them, maybe they're like nitpicky arguments. They can turn into nitpicky arguments, but they can also turn into fascinating conversations because they're so intense in their interests. So, you know, there's a lot there. It's not all difficult.
Let's go back to the phones. Ryan in Rochester, New Hampshire. Hi, Ryan. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi. Well, go ahead.
Good. I just wanted to mention that I'm 41 years old, and I've been married nearly 10 years, and I'm on the autism spectrum, and I didn't date until I was 30 years old. Mm. But I do want to let people know that it is possible to have a successful relationship and marriage if you are on the autism spectrum, because I am an example of that. Not that we don't have our problems, but...
Mm-hmm. So you started dating when you were 30. Was it just a matter of being nervous, scared, fearful?
No, it was a matter of being on the autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. I like to point out to people that... Mm-hmm. The 1980s and the early 1990s, autism back then was kind of like mixing oil with water. Mm-hmm. People didn't understand you and people didn't get you. It's not like it is today.
Mm-hmm. Ryan, thank you. Thank you very much. Dr. Witznitzer, what do you hear in Ryan there?
What I hear is someone who's comfortable and happy in his relationship. And again, it's in his own way, at the level that he wants it to be. And I remember we don't want to impose our ideas and our values. The comment you had made before about, you know, the family perceiving it as a difficult relationship, but the couple doesn't. And that's the whole point. It's not what the family wants. It's what's good for the couple itself and their relationship. And again, the message he's giving you, he's an individual. He just happens to have a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder, Asperger's syndrome, but he's still an individual first with the feelings and emotions of an individual. And areas of strength and weakness, and you work with that.
That's right. Roma is calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Roma. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to share. I have been married to my husband who has Asperger's. We've been married for 10 years, and 6 months into our marriage, a nurse friend of ours recognized some things with my husband, who at the time had not been diagnosed with Asperger's. And she gave us this book on Asperger's, and we read it together. My husband cried. My eyes were incredibly opened and changed forever. We ended up giving the book to his grandparents who raised him, and they said they felt like they had read this blueprint on their grandson. Mm. So it just, education, I can't stress enough to anyone, is a major importance. Now my husband is graduating from law school this semester, and I'm going to be honest, he did have to really learn some neurotypical skills. You know, he's had a lot of dinners with judges and lawyers and business conversation. He had to, you know, kind of, I don't want to say pass for neurotypical, but he had to, you know, kind of learn the rules of that world so that he could flow and have success in that arena.
Roma, thank you. Thank you very much for the call. Good luck to you. Dr. Witznitzer, Asperger's, of course, you know, relatively new disorder. Diagnoses really just started, 15, 20 years ago. Do you think this community is equipped as many now enter adulthood? Are we still learning? We're still learning so much. But is this community generally equipped as they grow up?
They're doing better because in the last 10, 15 years, we've recognized the importance of social skills learning, number one. And so that means that we've worked with these individuals to learn these kinds of skills and how to interact. As you heard the comment before, how to interact in the neurotypical world. You can implement the strategies. Why you implement them or how you implement them is your own idea. But secondly, as was also mentioned by another caller, our greater society is much more knowledgeable now about autism spectrum disorders than they were 20, 30, 40 years ago, and therefore that misunderstanding factor, that fear factor, that ignorance factor is not really there as much, and we can are more accepting and we can function better with the individuals, recognizing what we might call a quirk they see as an area of strength.
Ariet,
for example.
Amy Harmon, how do you see this community being equipped as they grow up?
Well, I think that they are definitely better equipped than previous generations were, and they're sort of that self-awareness that I spoke about earlier is helping them. I think the other thing to say maybe is that, you know, people with Asperger's syndrome, like all people in relationships, are not static, right? So as they do get out into the world and find themselves in relationships or trying to get into relationships, they are growing and changing just like all of us. And you know, in my book, I sort of chronicle a period in Jack and Kirsten's relationship that where they were at a turning point of sorts, and I wasn't really sure how it was going to turn out. And I saw even sort of in the few months that I followed them, that they reached a kind of a compromise that I wasn't sure they were going to find. But they changed and they grew, and I think they learned a lot from each other.
Important for all of us to keep in mind. Amy Harmon, national correspondent for the New York Times, joining us from New York City today. Her book is Asperger Love. It's an e-book, Searching for Romance When You're Not Wired to Connect. Amy, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
And Dr. Max Witznitzer, joining us from Sandusky, Ohio, practicing pediatric neurologist at Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital in Cleveland. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up Monday, listeners, we take On Point to Nashville, big medical center, to look at the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. Stay tuned for that. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.